sensitive environment, really, it's you really need to start by identifying what threats you have. I've had so many of our clients just come ask, like, you know, we need encryption. Can Postgres do encryption? Can you help us get Postgres to do encryption? And you feel, well, yeah, sure, in a lot of different ways, but what are you actually trying to protect against? And they have no idea. So any kind of secure deployment needs to start with actually identifying what the potential threats are. And I'm not going to go into how you do that, because that's really not a Postgres-specific task. It's more of a generic security task. And when you've done that, you need to apply the correct measures. Don't just enable every single security feature you can find just because it's there. Right? That'll only give you a lot of trouble maintaining it, and it may actually reduce your security because you think you're secure and you really aren't. Right? So what we're not going to talk about in this talk, in order to have at least a chance to cut it down to less than an hour, is we're not going to talk about application security at all. We're not going to talk about data access control, how you set your permissions in the database, or anything like that. If you want that, you should have been at Stephen Frost's tutorial 2 days ago, or maybe it's 3 days ago. You missed it. He may be back next year. We're not going to talk about data encryption, encrypting the data on your disk, encrypting the data in your database. We're not going to talk about that. There are a lot of other things we're not going to talk about. We're definitely not going to talk about Unix versus Windows from the context of security or from any other context. We're not going to talk about Linux versus BSD. We're not going to talk about SE Linux or SE Postgres that some of you may have heard of, like the sort of NSA-level security stuff. And we're not going to talk about anything other that's really religious, because that's what all of these kinds of discussions tend to end up being. Has anyone ever actually heard a factual discussion of security versus between Unix and Windows at a conference? I sure haven't. They're pretty hard to come by. So we're not going to talk about that. What are we going to talk about? We're going to cut it down to two things. We're going to talk about authentication, in particular the different authentication methods that Postgres supports. And what you can do with them. And we're going to talk about connection security. That is, how do you secure the step between your client and the server? We're not talking about the client side, we're not talking about the server side, but the sort of path in between. This comes down to SSL, mainly, in the Postgres term. So let's start at authentication methods. It's really about two things when we're talking Postgres. It's how do we determine who the user is. Okay, somebody's trying to connect to our database. Who is that? And what's he trying to do? And when do we actually determine who the user is? Do we do it when the user logs into the database? Or do we do it when the user logs into his PC? Or do we do it on every single request? Probably not, because that'll be slow. And we're talking about this from the database perspective, which means if you have your typical web application, you'll actually have only one user. If you have an intelligently developed web application, you'll have at least two users. But you won't have one database user for every single actual end user. If you're deploying a desktop application of any kind, then maybe you are. There may be one user in the database for every single user. It's probably the best way to actually manage to make a desktop application secure, unless you're building it through a web services layer or something like that, where it we're back to, from the database perspective, it's only one or two users. So in Postgres, we have this feature called host-based authentication. I'm sure you've all heard of the pghba.conf file. If you've ever either been it yourself or met someone who doesn't really know Postgres, they run up their first install, the first thing that happens is they get some kind of strange error message about pghba.conf and it can't log into the database. It's got to be one of the most common questions we have. Now, pghba can be in the way for the newbie in that case, but it's also the gateway to some very powerful functionality about setting up your authentication security with a very, very granular amount of control. What pghba.conf does is that it lets you choose different authentication methods depending on where the client is. The client may be a script running locally on your database server. That's pretty easy to secure. It may be your web server sitting one slot up in the rack in the data center. That's fairly easy to secure as well. It may be one of your salespeople on a roving laptop on the other end of the world. That's not so easy to secure. But it can be done. And in Postgres, if you're coming from another database, many of them supports one version or another of the username and password. Now, Postgres supports several different ways of dealing with username and password. And it also supports a lot of ways to log in that don't even have a password. They do all in some way or other have a username. But it may not be what you think it is. Now, you can do this for convenience. You can get automatic logins working. Or you can do it for security, which means that you clearly identify your security boundaries and define that if you're crossing a security boundary, well, then we need this type of authentication level. But if we're coming in from a secure zone, so to speak, then we don't need it. Now, these authentication methods can be internal or external. So you can have Postgres deal with the authentication all the way. Or we support plugins for many different systems so you can access already existing authentication infrastructure in your organization. Now, I'm sure most of you, who has never seen a pghpa.com file? Well, there's at least a couple, but not many. I kind of expect that. So here's an example of a very simple pghpa.com file. We got the first column, which basically tells us what type of connection this is. Postgres supports Unix connections and TCP connections. So if we say local, that means the Unix connection. If we say host, it means it's a TCP connection. And then we tell them which database is the user trying to access. And then we say which user is the user actually claiming to be. And if it's a TCP connection, we say which network is this user actually coming at us from. Is it connecting locally? Is it connecting from the internet? Is it connecting from a branch office? And finally, in the end, we say, okay, so how do we want to authenticate this user? There is actually several of these methods take further parameters, which will go further out on the line, but this is sort of the base file. It will be parsed from top to bottom, and the first match that's found will be used. So if you put a catch-all match on the first line, you can just ignore the rest of the file. And it's kind of easy to get that in the wrong order. Now, a quick show, this one just says, first line says, anybody connecting over a Unix domain socket, which means he's already on the machine, use the authentication method called trust. Anybody connecting from 127.0.0.1 localhost over TCP instead of Unix domain socket, use trust. If the user web user is trying to connect to the database WebDB from the network 10.0.0.0, then use MD5. So you'll need to match all of these in order to go. Yes? Yes. So if they're on the same network, you can just use the subnet mask. Otherwise, you're going to be needing to, because which of the IPs will be matched in the HPA file is actually up to the operating system. Postgres will only see one of those IPs. You don't need to do restart to change PGHPA. You need to reload. But we can change it on the fly. Yeah, correct. PGHPA just needs reload. So then it also has the functionality, if you look quickly at the last line, where we say any database, but the user trying to connect is a member of the role DBA, and he's from this network, then use DSS. And if none of these match, for example, if the user web user is trying to connect to the database template 1, none of these will match. And then we will do an implicit reject. So if there is no matching row, the user will not be able to log in. And this is a fairly common thing you'll see if the default PGHPA that ships with Postgres will have lines for local, and it will have lines for localhost. But when you enable it and listen over the network, the first error message you'll get is there is no matching row in pghpa.conf. And then you'll need to add one specifically for that network. So by default, we don't actually let anybody in anywhere. Now, the different authentication methods we can use. As you saw there in the first example, on the first line, we had trust authentication. And it's actually exactly as simple as it sounds. Any user can become anyone he or she claims to be. So if I log into the database and I claim I'm Magnus, then I'm logged in as Magnus, provided the account exists. If I claim I'm the super user Postgres, well, then I'm logged in as super user Postgres. There is no checks whatsoever, except that the fact that the user I'm claiming to be must exist. There's no way to prevent him from going in. Anyone think this may be a bad idea? Yeah. You probably don't ever want to use trust in your production system. And since you want to be testing on something that's at least remotely like your production system, you don't want to have it in your testing system either. Can anyone think of an actual use case for this? Okay, as long as you don't listen for connections over the network, then yeah, that will work. Robert? Yeah, so you can do that, but in that case, I'd use Ident, which will actually accomplish the same thing without being insecure. Ident, which I will get to on the next slide, I believe. Jeff, have an idea? But again, I'd say it'll be easier to use Ident. So a use case that I've come across fairly often for this is once you've lost your password, right? You'll need to flip this on to reset your own password. That's one of the only real actual use cases in a production system that I've been able to find for this, where it actually makes sense from a security perspective. Because once you've lost your super user password, this will be your only way to get in. But in general, on your production system, this should not be on. If you have a security auditing system in place, it should audit for anybody putting trust in your PGHPA file. Because that's just an accident waiting to happen. Now, we also have the username password, which is what everybody does, right? Every database, except possibly SQLite, has username password. This is what people expect when they log into your database. So it's a reasonable default in a lot of cases. For this, we use the method called MD5. There is a method called password, which will store the password in plain text. Don't do that. There used to be a method called crypt, which used the Unix API function crypt. It's been deprecated for a while, and it has now, I think, as of 8.4, it's been removed. So if you have that in an older version, it's gone. MD5 will solve your problems in general. It'll do an MD5 on the file, on the password when it's stored. There will be a second MD5 before it goes over the wire, so it's reasonably secure. If you're doing username passwords, use MD5. We can also do LDAP. Many organizations who have a number of machines will at some point have an LDAP directory. Now, if you have your end users connecting directly to the database, it's not a bad idea to use LDAP for that. To the client, be it PSQL or PGAdmin or your Java application or whatever, LDAP authentication looks just like username password. The Postgres server will request the password from the client. And when it comes back, instead of verifying it against the list of users that we have in the database, we'll just pass it along to the LDAP server. And we'll ask it, hey, here is user Magnus. He's trying to log in with his great password. Is that him? And we'll just get a yes, no back. And if it's a yes, we'll let the user in. If it's a no, well, we won't. LDAP servers are, of course, common in pretty much any larger enterprise will have them, and they'll give you the advantages of doing things like password policies. All passwords must be at least N number of characters. Password expiries, everybody needs to change the password at least once every 3 hours. Things like that, that we all know increase security incredibly, but policies may be in place.
Setting the password
So Postgres does not provide any functionality for changing your password when you're on LDAP login. You'll need to talk directly to the LDAP server for that. And they will usually, most LDAP servers will have the functionality that lets you sort of verify, set all your policies and stuff. Postgres will only use the LDAP server for verifying the login.
You also have to create the role in the database?
Yes. You can never log in with a user that doesn't exist. Now, there is sort of a hack around that I will get to later if you actually don't want it. But in general, we will never automatically create your users for you. You can write a script to do that, but Postgres by default requires the role to actually exist in the database. Yep. Postgres will send the password in clear text to the LDAP server. We do, however, fully support LDAP over SSL between the Postgres server and the LDAP server. Now, what this gives you, a lot of people say, hey, LDAP is great. It gives you single sign-on. No, it doesn't. LDAP will give you single password. You get the same password to every system that's connected to this LDAP, but you actually have to input it in every application, right? That's why it works. And sort of one of these nice little graphic things. We got the client. What's going to happen is the client connects to Postgres. Postgres sends a password request to the client. Some kind of password goes back, and we just sort of pass that down to the LDAP server. There is no magic anywhere in this. It's just we ask somebody else to verify the password for us and let us know if it's okay or not. Oops. There is some news coming out in Postgres 9.0 with regards to LDAP authentication. The main thing is Postgres, prior to 9.0, supported an LDAP bind authentication. It means that we set a couple of parameters in the PGHPA file, which is a prefix and a suffix. And between the prefix and the suffix, we'd stick the username. And then we'd send that off to the LDAP server. Now, this only works if all your users are stored in the same hierarchical location in the LDAP tree, which they don't always do. There is actually a workaround it for the most common LDAP tree, which would be Microsoft Active Directory, whereby we could do this in 8.4 and earlier by using the old-style Windows login way of domains and whatever. What we support in 9.0 is what's known as a search and bind authentication, which means that we will connect to the server and we'll actually search for the user first. And once we've figured out where it is, then we'll try to log in. This means you can have your users in different locations. Normally in your LDAP tree, you might have one container or organizational unit for each department in your company or something like that. So for this, you give it a way to connect, and then you create something called an LDAP filter in 9.0. The filter will say, for example, match UID equals the one we're putting in, and we'll just do a global search, and we'll tell you where to start the search.
Kevin? Will you be able to restrict what groups have access?
Able to restrict?
You can
put anything you want in the LDAP filter. So as long as your LDAP server supports filtering on that, then yes. The most common choice here is that it actually turns out that pretty much any Unix-based LDAP server will store your user ID in, well, UID. It won't store it in the common name. So it was actually very hard in 8.4 to use this in a large enterprise with a non-Active Directory LDAP. It'll work perfectly fine in 9.0, and the search plus bind is what most LDAP clients expect you to do. Another thing we added that actually may make you not need to use LDAP in a lot of cases, in version 9.0 again, we added support for radius login. So how many people in here know what radius is? Oh, that's good. That's a start. So radius is remote authentication dial-in user service, right? So we're back to the good old days of dial-up internet. That's when this was created. It was created to deal with ISPs with thousands of modems, right? So every time someone tries to log in, you have a central login server somewhere. That's what Radius was made for. It's a very simple single packet UDP service. So the client, in this case the Postgres server, sends a single UDP packet to the Radius server, which responds with a single UDP packet back saying yes or no. It's that simple, which means it's very, very lightweight. It is also a very common framework if you're deploying solutions for one-time password. these little tokens from RSA or Vasco or whatever that'll automatically generate your little 8-digit code that you input into the system to log in. Almost all of them support Radius. And that is the use case that Radius was developed for particularly. The Radius servers tend to have very good policy frameworks. For example, this user is only allowed to log in during business hours, and that kind of restrictions. We don't have any of those in Postgres itself. We'll just offload that to the server which Radius tends to be very good at. Radius is very easy to set up in Postgres. You simply point out, this is my Radius server, and it's got something called a shared secret, which is used to encrypt the password back and forth. And that's pretty much all you do. We'll send the username over. Same as with LDAP, we'll just get the response back. If it's a yes, we'll let you in. If it's a no, we won't. Again, we still need to have the role created in the Postgres system for this to work. For some more advanced authentication, particularly in the LAN environment, we have support for Kerberos, GSS API, and SSPI. Now, these are basically the same thing, right? GSS API normally would run on top of Kerberos. Kerberos is the wire protocol. SSPI is the Microsoft version that only works on Windows. But if everything you have is both Windows servers and Windows clients, then SSPI is much easier to set up because it's already set up for you once you install your Windows machine. It has some fairly similar benefits to LDAP. It gets you this whole the central registry. You got your users created in one place, etc. The difference is it actually gives you single sign-on, not single password. So with any of these methods, the client doesn't actually have to input his password, and we can still securely log him into the database. The by far most common deployment of Kerberos is Microsoft Active Directory. Right? As of Windows 2000, when they put that in, everything in Windows is based off Kerberos. But it's pretty common. There are two large implementations on Unix. There is MIT Kerberos and Heimdall. So it's fairly common in Unix environments, but it's a bit more complex to set up. Like I said, Postgres has Kerberos, GSS API, and SSPI. The KRB5, which is the native Kerberos method, has been deprecated. Don't use that. GSS API is an industry standard protocol on top of this method. It gives you all the same benefits, and it's the standard. So we encourage you to use that. It's also better cross-platform compatibility in it. We will support anything you can configure your GSS API client library to deal with. That is out of scope at this point. We don't do that. So, now, the difference in Kerberos, if we compare it to the LDAP login we had before, is that in Kerberos, you got something called a ticket. Right? The whole system is based on the fact that when you log into, say, your desktop, you get what is known as a ticket granting ticket, which is the Kerberos system of saying, hey, you're you. Now, when you connect to Postgres, it's actually going to connect to something called a KDC, a key distribution center that is a part of your Kerberos infrastructure. If you're in a Windows environment, that's the one you call domain controller. It's called KDC in the Kerberos. You will present your password or this ticket granting ticket, and you will get back something called a service ticket. Then your client will connect to the Postgres server and just say, hey, I'm Magnus, here's my ticket. And if you've set up Kerberos properly, there are encryption keys between all these machines that will let the Postgres server validate and know that you are this user without actually having to see a password, without having to talk to the KDC, without having to do anything. So this gives you true single sign-on. Once you've logged in, you have your ticket, you can log into any configured Postgres server and just drop right in, and it's perfectly secure. Not like Trust, which will let you drop right in, but this one won't let you log in as anyone you want. Kerberos can be a bit of a pain to set up, but if you have a large number of fat clients, it will be worth it because your users won't have to type in their passwords all the time, which will hopefully decrease the number of passwords on yellow Post-it notes. You're going to have to, at some point, log into the KDC. Right. So the password needs to be somewhere anyway. I would not do it for a large web form. I would try to find another way. It's really directed towards using the users. Now, the advantage is this initial login here to the KDC will also support anything that the KDC supports. For example, smart card logins. It'll all, once, that Postgres doesn't care about that. It just cares about getting a signed ticket from the KDC. However you got that, that's the KDC's problem. We do have support for PAM, which is the pluggable authentication modules. It's provided by the operating system. It's on Linux. It's on Solaris. I don't know if it's on Mac. It's most definitely not on Windows. And the PAM can do pretty much anything. You can actually use PAM to authenticate against your system password database. You just need to give Postgres full ownership and write permissions of your etc directory, which is obviously a brilliant idea. But you can. It can do Kerberos. It'll be a lot harder to get that right than to use the native Kerberos GSS API support. It can do LDAP. It'll be a lot more flexible to use the native support. Prior to version 9.0, I'd say the most common actual use case for this is, again, the one-time password systems, RSA systems, VASCO, or any other pure radius system. In 9.0, that's gone, mainly because PAM is not available on all platforms. But if you use the PAM that's in the radius that's built into Postgres, you don't have to deal with setting up PAM, which can be hard. And you gain the sort of platform independence of that. So the number of use cases for PAM have decreased over the years as we've added more of this functionality into Postgres in order to support all platforms. Did I actually manage? Okay, I managed to delete the wrong slide, which is brilliant. So let's stay at that and talk about the ident authentication, which is the deleted slide, right? Ident authentication is, it gives you a way that Postgres will ask the kernel, who is this user? It works for local connections and TCP connections. Don't ever use it for TCP. How many people regularly log into IRC? Yeah. IRC tends to ask you for your ident still to log in, right? This is why many IRC clients for Windows come with an ident server that lets you configure any username you want. That would also let you log into Postgres with any username you want. Ident really relies on the old way that everybody logs in from a trusted server somewhere that the users never have root on. Yeah, that doesn't happen these days. But ident on the local machine will ask the kernel for the login. So if I'm logged in as Magnus in the operating system, the kernel will ensure that Postgres finds out about that and will let me log in as that user. So ident is, if your users are going to be logging in from your local console, ident is a very good idea. It will ensure that user Magnus can only log in as user Magnus in the database without having to input the password again. But like I said, never use ident over TCP. I haven't found a single use case where that actually makes sense. Unfortunately, a couple of years back, well, fairly many now, we decided to overload the meaning of ident on these two completely different authentication method, one of which is one of the most secure we have, and one of which is one of the least secure that we have. But that's legacy, and we're stuck with it. But ident used locally is a very secure way, and you just sort of map the username. That is only supported on Unix platforms, nothing on Windows. It's not supported on all Unix platforms, but it's supported on the major ones, Linux, BSD, Solaris. But I don't think we support it on things like HP UX or weird things like that. It's not. I'm pretty sure it's on Solaris. Okay, it's not in the packages? Okay, so don't run it on Solaris. You can tell I'm not using Solaris much. So now that I've gone over the slide that I accidentally deleted, I was going to move on to the second part, which is going to be on the SSL part. This is about securing the connection. And it also ties in with how we do the authentication. Because SSL will provide us with three different things. Right? It will provide us with encryption. That's what most people think of when they think SSL. If you set it up correctly, it will provide you with man-in-the-middle protection, which is what most people don't manage to set it up to prevent. They think they did, but they didn't. And finally, we can use SSL for authentication, which is definitely one of the most secure ways of doing authentication in Postgres. Now, SSL is actually pretty simple to get going. You go into Postgres.conf, you set SSL equals yes, and you're done. Well, no, not quite. That is sort of the Debian way. Debian will enable SSL by default. So if you're running a Debian server, the first thing you do is you go into the configuration server, you look up the SSL equals yes, and you change it to no. If you just enable SSL without actually configuring anything else, you have only slowed down your system without increasing security. Unfortunately, it's the default on Debian and Debian-based distributions like Ubuntu. You're going to need to set up certificates and a lot of things like that. So, but in theory, once you set SSL equals yes, you're good to go. In the hba.conf file, you can, for each individual line, require SSL on a connection, saying if the user is connecting from this address, he must use SSL. For example, anything that comes in over the internet must use SSL. You can also optionally require it on the client side, saying I'm only going to connect to this server if it speaks SSL. Otherwise, I don't want to talk to him because I care about my data. Now, what a lot of people miss out is you actually need to connect. You need to protect data going in both directions, right? If you're protecting your data, you're sending your data is actually important, right? You don't want people to look at it. That data is coming one way, but you probably want to protect it in both directions because if you're not actually protecting your password, it doesn't help to protect the data. It really goes the other way as well. Some people sometimes come up and ask us, well, you know, MD5 is broken, right, for passwords. We know that. MD5 is bad. You should use, like, SHA-512. And we still use MD5 for passwords because, frankly, if your password is the only thing you care about, you probably don't need anything more than MD5. If you actually care about what your password is protecting, you need to be using SSL over the connection. So, like we said, for example, the username password must be. Now, the second part that I'm going to come back to here is that you must actually know, if you want this to be secure, both sides need to know before the connection is started that this will be encrypted or this will be secured via SSL. If we don't know, we must treat it as insecure. So if I'm a client and I say connect to this server and I don't really care if it's SSL or not, then I'm basically saying anybody sitting between here and that server, I don't care if they read my password, I don't care if they read my data contents. If I have the server saying, hey, this must use SSL, it's still not secure because the client doesn't know. The client might be connecting to the wrong server by mistake. There might be an attacker that has been redirecting traffic. So we need to know, and if we don't know that security has been enabled, if we don't know that SSL encryption and checking has been enabled, we must treat the connection as insecure. Now, SSL is always going to be requiring a server-side certificate. Right? On your Postgres server, you must have an X509 certificate. It's a base requirement of the SSL protocol. This can be a self-signed certificate. There is actually nothing wrong at all with using a self-signed certificate if you use it the right way. And this certificate does not actually need to be known by the client. In a high-security environment, you're going to want it to be, but it doesn't need to get things working. Now, a quick primer on SSL certificates, the, like, 30-second overview. SSL certificates form chains. A server has a certificate. Each certificate has an issuer. So the server certificate may have what's called as an intermediate certificate as the issuer. What this means is that this certificate contains a digital signature made by this certificate. Now you can walk up the chain an unlimited number of steps where each step has a digital signature from the step above it. And at one point you read something called a root certificate where the issuer is basically recursively pointing back to itself. So the signature on the root certificate is actually made by the root certificate. This is what you'll find if you look in your web browser. You have a couple of hundred root certificates preloaded. They are all this kind of certificate that they have signed themselves, and then the browser manufacturer have decided that, hey, I trust these guys. Usually a bad idea, but they made that decision. So this means that if you're actually using self-signed certificates, that's this. You just sort of scratch all this stuff, and you only have a root certificate. It has signed itself. That is a self-signed certificate. So every single high security SSL root you have in your system is actually a self-signed certificate. If you have a reasonably small organization, you can live fine with having just that. If you have many servers, you will usually have at least one level down. Because the idea is that once you have the root certificate, you can verify using the signature anything coming from anybody down here. So you only need to know the root to verify the whole tree. So how do the SSL secured connections actually work and what do they prevent? Your typical case here, let's say we have our client, we are somehow going over a network with a couple of routers and we go into the server. So the most common thing that people think about, like, so what are the attacks against this? Well, the most common one is, hey, we've got an eavesdropper, right? You can just network monitor this. Like I said, if anybody out here is using PSQL directly over the wireless, well, we can read your queries. We can read the data coming out. We can read your MD5 hashed password. We can read all of this stuff. It's actually much easier than you'd like it to be, both on wireless and wired. So if anybody has access to the network anywhere on, they can read that. Now, SSL protects against this pretty easily. We do this by encrypting all the data. So you can read the encrypted data, and we just assume you can't crack it. SSL will do automatic key negotiation. So that's what the certificate is initially needed for, to seed the choice of encryption keys. So you don't need to care about it. It will do key negotiation on initial connection. It will renegotiate after 512 megabytes of traffic by default. As of, I think it's 842 or 843, it was added a couple of weeks ago, months ago. You can actually configure exactly how long this is if you have a broken client library. There was a major bug in the SSL protocol itself that made this renegotiation completely insecure. Like, completely. So you'd have to turn it off. And what happened then was that a couple of large system vendors shipped versions of the SSL libraries that turned this off in an incorrect way, that broke Postgres and many other applications. That's why we added a parameter so you could just turn it off. Now, if your system is up to date, say your Red Hat or Debian or whatever has the current version of the libraries, you can leave that on. It's perfectly secure. But if you have an old version of the libraries, it's not. So in this case, we're using the server certificate, but we don't really care what it is. But we need it to initiate the encryption. I added the slide on that. So this is the broken SSL protocol. Like I said, the parameter's name is SSL renegotiation limit. The default will be 512 megabytes. Most people don't ever end up transferring much more than that over a single connection, but if you do, it will renegotiate to make crypt analysis a little bit harder on your data. So the second threat that SSL will actually be able to protect you against is the man-in-the-middle attack. So not only is it pretty trivial to actually eavesdrop on your traffic, it's much easier than you'd like to actually insert a man-in-the-middle attack, which is basically we insert a fake machine down here. We claim it's the server, which means that the client will be connecting to the fake server, which can then read all your data, and the fake server will connect to the real server so it can execute the queries, because since it read all your data, it knows your password. Now, by default, as we've set up SSL, or as if you've not done anything more, SSL does not actually protect you against this. Because this here is a perfectly valid SSL session with whatever 128 or 256-bit encryption that you can't eavesdrop on, and it terminates right here. And then it goes clear text, and then you have a new completely valid SSL session. But you can read it in the middle, and you will never know. And it's fairly easy to actually put this man-in-the-middle thing in place, as long as there is any part of your network that is not fully trusted. This is why you actually need to think about SSL more than just setting SSL equals yes. So how do we do this? We add something called SSL server verification. It runs on top of encryption. So you have encryption first, and then you add SSL server verification on top of that. And it's basically, it gives the client a chance to verify that the server it's connecting to is the one it claims to be. We do this using the certificates. The client will know about the root certificate in the chain. And what it'll do is when we connect to the server, it'll make sure that the certificate used on the server is signed, potentially through several others on the way, but it is signed by the certificate that the client knows. So by doing this, we know that this guy here, unless he managed to copy the certificate or have us generate a certificate for him, we're going to connect here, and before we even start transmitting data, we're going to say, hey, this guy has the wrong certificate. We're not going to talk to you. And he's not going to see anything. And SSL will do this extremely early on in the protocol, so it's long before we send the password. It's even before we send the username. It's one of the first things that will happen is we'll notice this is the wrong certificate. We're not going to talk to you. So in order to protect against this, we need, even if we can use a self-signed certificate, we can use the certificate tree, but the client needs to know the certificates. This is what goes under the name of PKI, right? Public key infrastructure. We need to distribute these certificates somehow. I'm not sure I know enough encryption to explain that to you.
And the answer is it doesn't have
the private key. Yeah, right. Sure. So, yeah, because the private key and the signature goes into that. So, yeah, that step of the SSL is it uses RSA or DSA asymmetric encryption. But again, this also means that the certificates that you do have need to be protected. Because if an attacker can get a copy of your certificate, he's good to go. Postgres will normally, by default, it will have you put these files in your data directory. But there are config parameters you can say, I store my S certificates over here. Yeah, once they're in your system, but then they'll have to first break into your system, which hopefully you protect it with. For example, SSL client authentication. It also runs on top of encryption, and it's basically exactly the same thing except backwards. Right? In server verification, we have the client validate that the signature on the certificate was correct. In this, we also have the server. We have the client submit a certificate when it tries to connect. So in this scenario, every single client needs its own certificate. It will submit this when it tries to connect, and the server will match it against its known list of root certificates. And if it's okay, you'll get in. What we'll do here is we're able to use the field called CN, which is the common name on the certificate. You put the username in there, and we'll match that to make sure you log in as the correct username. This pretty much requires that you have a proper PKI solution in place. You're not going to want to be doing this and manually handing out certificates. But if you have an enterprise PKI solution, it's actually pretty easy to have each client get its certificate properly. You can put these certificates on a smart card. In the Postgres case, anything that OpenSSL supports as an engine, you can put the certificate on that. But it is important that you protect the client certificate because it doesn't actually need a password. Once you have the certificate, you're good to go, which is why smart cards may be a good idea. So SSL client authentication will just reverse the server auth and make sure you need certificates on both sides to make this work. And it basically, comparing it to the LDAP one, this is how that one works. Client connects, presents its certificate, done. The certificate itself contains all the information necessary to verify it. It has the signature, so we never need to talk to your PKI servers or anything to do this. It's all there. It will need to be provided separately, and it will be matched against the certificate.
Okay. But does the client also send a password?
No. A password is never sent when you're using certificate authentication. Just the encryption keys. Yes? you can do that as well. You can do that as well. You can match. You can say it requires a certificate, but we'll use the password for logging in, which means that you're going to end up needing both. So yes, there are definite use cases for that, which is this slide. You can use it together with the other authentication. At that point, we just require the client cert. We don't actually use it to log in. So you need the client cert to connect, and then we'll let you in through the normal authentication, which may be username, password. It may be Kerberos. It may be Radius. It doesn't really matter which one. So the final important part around this is SSL and libpq. Now, this is not actually specific for libpq. It is for any client you're using, but libpq is the Postgres project-supported one. You'll have similar parameters in, for example, the JDBC driver. They're not named exactly the same. Now, SSL and libpq is controlled by the connection parameter called SSL mode, or you can control it by the environment variable PGSSL mode, just like all libpq connection variables have matching environment variables. And again, remember this, for security, this must be set on the client because unknown equals insecure. And if we set it on the server, the client doesn't know until it's too late. So we actually need to control our SSL connections from the client as well. If we don't do that, we don't know, and we've just given up most of our security stuff here. So here's a little matrix of some parameters. Out here in the end, we have the client mode. This is what you put in the SSL certificate. In the SSL mode parameter. Here's what we got protection against. We got eavesdropping and man in the middle, right? So we can see if we set SSL mode to disable, well, it doesn't protect us at all. There is no real surprise in that, huh? We have a mode called allow. That means that the client will, if the server doesn't care, the client's going to connect without SSL. But if the server insists on there being SSL, we'll talk SSL to the server. That's fine. Now, this actually means we have no protection. Because remember, unknown equals insecure. We don't know that it's encrypted, therefore we must treat it as if it's not. The next mode up is the prefer mode. That says we'd like to talk SSL to the server if they accept it, but if the server doesn't have a certificate or something like that, we'll just go ahead and talk plain text. This also doesn't protect us at all, because we don't know. If an attacker puts a man in the middle server, he just needs to not put a certificate on it and will connect without any kind of encryption. We can then set mode require. That means if the server doesn't speak SSL, we will not connect. So this will protect us against eavesdropping because we're ensured there will be encryption. It does not protect us against man in the middle attacks because we'll connect to him regardless of which certificate he has. Up until Postgres 8.4, this was actually the best we could do. Postgres 8.4 added two more parameters, which are verify CA and verify full. These are the only ones that protect you fully against both eavesdropping and man-in-the-middle attacks. Now, verify CA will do the verification we mentioned before. It'll make sure the server certificate is trusted before we connect. If you enable verify full, it will also look at the common name attribute of the server certificate and match this against the server name we're trying to connect to. The difference between these two is what you get in your web browser as a big warning that says, hey, this certificate belongs to another site. That kind of warning would have verify full reject your connection, whereas verify CA would say, hey, it may be for the wrong server, but I trust this certificate, let's go. So which one of these you want to use will actually depend on your PKI deployment, if you're actually putting the full server names into every certificate or not, if that's necessary or not. But you will need one of these two in order to be protected against man-in-the-middle attacks. Now, is this compatible on the server side? On the server, we just set SSL required or SSL disabled. Those are the two things, right? If we've on the client set SSL disabled, and on the server said SSL require, obviously we're not going to be able to connect. If we have on the server side SSL disabled and the client is in either allow or prefer mode, that's just going to work. Both allow and prefer are going to work with anyone. They're both very sort of easy on that. Now, if we set SSL to require on the client, we can no longer connect if the server doesn't have SSL. Now, that's good, obviously. That's what we expect. And the same for our verify CA and verify full. If the server doesn't have SSL, we will never be able to connect. The final one here, SSL has a fair amount of overhead. It will slow your things down, particularly if you have lots of connections, because the initial connection negotiation is expensive. And trying to sort of translate the what we think, what we can adapt to when it comes to this overhead into actual English words, we can say that SSL equals disable means we're saying we will never pay this overhead. We just don't. If the server requires to pay the overhead, then we're not going to talk to them because we know we're going to transfer too much data. Now, in allow mode, we say, okay, we'll pay the overhead if it's necessary, but we'd prefer not to. In prefer mode, we actually say, we'll pay the overhead if possible, but if the server insists on there not being any overhead, then okay, we'll do it without the overhead. That is the negotiation that we say, if we say prefer, we'll attempt to connect with SSL. And if that fails, we'll fall back and connect without SSL. And if we say any of the require, verify CA, and verify full, then yes, we're saying we're going to pay the overhead. We want the security, we'll always pay the overhead, and we're perfectly fine doing that. Now, the interesting one here is this one. Notice the difference between these two. Here we're saying, if at all possible, we'd like to pay the overhead, we're not getting any protection. We're just saying, hey, my system's running way too fast. This is not good. I want to slow this down. My users are getting like speed blind. Can anyone find a use case for that? No, didn't think so. Can anyone guess what the default is in libpq? Yeah, that's this one. Yeah. So does this one. So does this one, except that one you'll only pay the overhead if you have to. You're basically asking for something that doesn't give you any extra security, but it gives you worse performance. No, no, it doesn't. What if the server doesn't have a certificate?
Well, then if the server doesn't have to do SSL.
Yeah, you're still going to connect and send your password. Yeah, but so does this one. They both do. Right, okay, so, yeah. So I guess there is a use case for it if your server is misconfigured. That's basically what you're saying. So unfortunately, that is the default. So this is another good point that if you're going to deploy SSL, you need to actually think it through. Exactly what you're trying to do. And if you're using SSL to deploy a secure solution, you'll want to be at least at require and probably at one of the verify options.
Has anyone considered the SSH like
No. We've not really considered
it.
There might be a way to do that, yes, but no, that's not something that we do today, so yes. Yeah. But this is a client-side function. The client will know if it supports it. This is this parameter out here is something you set on the client. I guess you could do that, but if you just set it to, in this case, set it to require, and you're actually secure. Now, the unfortunate side effect of this is, again, the most common unfortunate side effect we see of this is anybody using a Debian-based platform, right? We've enabled it on the server, and we've set prefer to default, which means that by default on your Debian platform, you're gonna get SSL overhead whenever you're connecting with TCP, which is kind of unnecessary. Because it doesn't actually give you any extra security from a determined attacker. So this is another thing. If you're well, if you disable SSL on your server completely, then you will never pay the overhead. But if you're deploying something that actually needs to be secure, you need to look at this client mode. These parameters will be valid for anything that's based off libpq, which is things like libpq itself. You got the Perl driver, the Python driver. It is not valid for JDBC or .NET. They have their own ways of doing this. They have the similar functionality. I think actually the JDBC driver is smart enough not to have prefer as the default mode. I don't even think they support it. But you'll need to look at that if you're going in there. So a final comment that's actually not at all about Postgres. If you're doing this in like an enterprise LAN environment, do consider using IPsec, particularly if it's already deployed in your organization. There are tools, for example, if your LAN happens to be a Microsoft Active Directory and Windows-based LAN, this stuff is all built in. And there are packages for most other systems that will make it fairly easy to sort of just say, hey, nobody can talk here unless they're secured, unless they're one of our approved machines. The good thing about IPsec, it's application transparent. Postgres will think it's communicating in clear text, but you know that it's encrypted. It'll let you set things like global policies on in your policy server and stuff. It usually comes with integrated management. And not the least, probably in a larger organization, it's probably going to be somebody else's problem because that's going to be the network guys and not you.
What is IPsec?
It's basically encrypted IP. So it'll, if you set up IPsec for everything, it means that any IP traffic gets encrypted by the operating system, but the application doesn't have to care. Yes, that too. Netcards, particularly server-side netcards, come with IPsec in hardware. Yeah, or to a gateway machine. And I mean, it's sort of a VPN without having to actually set up the VPN. It'll just do it. Well, there are many different modes and stuff around IPsec, but personally, I find this the most important thing. It's no longer the DBA's problem. So I let the network guy deal with it. We just say, hey, we want secure connections. You go deal with it. It has some serious advantages not to have to deal with it. Well, that's all I had, and I think I'm reasonably good on time. We have 2 minutes for questions. Well, if there are no more questions, then I guess you get 2 minutes of extra break before the next session. So thank you very much for coming.